All right, what we do here on Sidewalk Radio is we test the levels. So you can have this about like right here.
Okay.
Whatever you feel comfortable. How you doing?
Pretty good. How is that?
It's looking pretty good. Tell me about...
One, two, three. Avery's got a cross-country match today that I'm going to miss. Traffic Armageddon is out there.
Yeah, it is, isn't it?
It's not so bad yet, but...
But the threat of it.
Mm-hmm. And then there was a big thunderclap, which was sort of like awesome foreboding. Like, just like, forget it, everybody. Thunderclap? Yeah.
Is that like golf clap?
Yeah. Oh, man.
Is it? I mean, we don't classify claps as much as we probably should in America.
Yeah, what if they did thunderclaps instead of golf claps?
That'd be fun. You could do it at the monster truck event.
Yeah.
Jamie.
Yes.
I am familiar with you and your work.
Yes.
But let's tell the Sidewalk Radio listeners who you are and what you do.
Okay. This is like the question I always stumble over. So I'm a writer. And then when I tell people I'm a writer, they generally ask like, okay, so what do you write? And that's really, I really sort of stumble.
But you don't stumble on your name, do you?
Oh, Jamie.
Should we start
Allen.
With that?
Yeah. Yeah, my name's Jamie Allen. I'm a writer in Atlanta.
Nice. Yeah. See? Oh, perfect.
Yeah. That was easy. And then what do? I write nonfiction stories, write fiction, write humor pieces, and I create something called the Inman Park Squirrel Census.
I think we should talk about all that.
Okay.
So today I thought that it could be fun to take what we typically and traditionally know as... you know, a book reading or author talk that we might see in person, and on the radio have the added benefit of a little personal background and dialogue along with it. And so I always think it kind of makes sense to begin at the beginning. I know where you're from, but let's tell people where you're from and maybe some of your earliest memory.
Okay. So I'm from Tampa, Florida. I was born there in 68, not too long after air conditioning became a thing. And there's a sort of a mass movement down there with, I guess, baby boomers are going down there to set up their lives. You know, lots of suburban neighborhoods were set up in and around Tampa. My earliest memory, honestly, I think it was, I had like a series of memories of crying. And back then, it wasn't like I was sad. It was that I would wake up or come out of something with the way you come out of, like, tears in your eyes. And I've thought about that, like, a number of different times, like, what it meant. And I think you can only go so far ascribing so much meaning to memories. But, you know, it probably meant that I was, like, 2 years old and I was throwing a temper tantrum and it meant something to me and I cried and then that there was a memory.
Yeah, but it stuck with you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You are a sentimental type.
Sensitive. Yeah.
Sensitive.
Yeah.
It comes through, I mean, like all good writers, I think that voice and that personality shows through in writing.
Mm-hmm. I was probably described as a crybaby more than most people.
Should we edit that part out?
I would have, in the past I would have said yes, but no, I think it's, you know, it's like, that's kind of who I was. And I think it was because just like things meant a lot to me and I felt them pretty strongly. I don't want to say I felt them more strongly than others, but that was the way it came bursting out of me. And then, you know, as I don't think I'm a crybaby anymore. So, I mean, you know,
so we've known each other for a while now, and I've had the pleasure and the honor of being able to like collaborate with you, and you've helped me and my company and this radio show for that matter, I think immensely in being able to craft and share the story. So like when I think about what you do, I think about that, you know, you're a storyteller.
Mm-hmm.
And knowing some of your history, you're a pretty competitive person, but I never get the sense that you're a competitive person. I get the sense that you're just a good person that wants to help others, but you do have a pretty sincere competitive streak. I mean, mm-hmm. baseball, I think, would be a good example of that.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Do you feel like that, paradox?
Yeah. It's, so when you play baseball, I grew up playing baseball from the time I was five until through college. And it's pretty, straightforward. Like, if you want to compete with somebody, you just compete with them. And that's what the sport is all about. And, you know, if that includes like trash talking or like, you know, whatever, you know, some players resort to, you know, baseball players have resorted to other methods to improve their game, as we all know. But like, for me, it was really straightforward to express myself on the baseball field in that way. And it really meant a lot to me. And after I left college, I don't think I knew that I immediately wanted to be a writer, because really it was the only other thing that I was good at, like through school. I didn't realize, number one, how difficult it would be to be a writer, thankfully. And then the other thing was that I didn't realize that there are different rules attached to being a writer, especially in the, like the competitive sense. You know, I didn't think about that until you brought that up, but like, you know, I think a lot of writers would admit that, you know, there's some really, you know, good writers with like, you know, low egos out there. And then there's a lot of writers with huge egos, and there's a catty competitiveness out there. And, but it's funny because like to come out and straightforward compete with like another writer, it's just not done. You just don't do that. Right. Like, why would you do that? And on the same note, it's like,
I could see that happening on like, you know, Saturday Night Live. Like, you're trying to get your sketch done. Mm-hmm. And someone else isn't, or,
yeah,
political like speechwriters or something like that. It seems like a lot more cutthroat than the prose that you write.
Yeah, I was. I tried to write a humor piece one time and it just failed. I just tried to write it over and over and it never worked out. So I'll just give the concept here. But it's essentially like Iron Chef, except it's Iron Writer. And Hemingway is essentially the Iron Chef, or your favorite writer, whatever it is, whoever your favorite writer is. And you go on there and you compete with them. You're given a subject, like a whale instead of an ingredient. And then go, you sit across from each other and type it out. Who's going to come up with the best?
Can you think like that, or just verbally? Or do you have to be putting pen to paper or keystroke to screen?
Usually for me, it comes into play in a concept first in my head, and a feeling in my chest. And maybe just in my brain. I think for a lot of writers it's that way. And then for me, the writing part of it was something I had to learn later. So it's like, and it's a terrible metaphor, but it's just one that pops into my head, where it's like if a story is like oil, you got some oil in you, you know?
Yeah.
The writing process is actually inventing the apparatus to drill down into the ground and pull it out. And, you know, some writers have like the most advanced apparatus to pull out the oil. You know, they're Exxon. And then some of us have, you know, like the old, you know, 19th century, like hand pump kind of thing. Yeah. Yeah.
I like it.
Yeah. But the idea is that like writing isn't just like sitting down in front of a computer and working with words. It's a big part of it. But it's like trying to take that feeling, that story, and then present it on paper as accurately as it feels inside you.
So you brought some magazines with you today.
Yes.
What'd you bring?
So I've had a couple of pieces published recently in the Oxford American. One is about squirrels, which has become a subject that's pretty close to my heart. It's related to the MM Park Squirrel Census, which is a thing that I do. It's we go out and count squirrels and make infographics and engage with the community. And through that, I've had a lot of interactions with squirrels. And so I approached them and said, I think I have a story here. And they're great. The Oxford American people are great. And so they worked with me, and we came up with a piece. And then after that, this past summer, I had a piece published on the actually on the website about a visit that I took to Key West with my kids, and we went to the Hemingway house. If that isn't like built-in comedy right there, it was a really entertaining visit, and then something happened at the Hemingway house that pretty much right when it was happening, I was thinking, oh man, I gotta write about this.
Yeah, so just to kind of recap, you're a writer, you're a storyteller, you have a love and passion for baseball and squirrels, and you're a dad.
Yeah.
Well, that pretty much sum it up for the moment.
Yes. A dad to a 17-year-old and a 14-year-old. Lots of entertainment there.
Yeah. A lot of material.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it'd be fun to hear a little bit. Well, before we get into like some reading, tell me about Oxford American. Like what type of magazine is it, and what was your feeling knowing that you would be published in it?
Well, Oxford American is like, for writers in the South in particular, but I think all over, it's just one of those, like for me, like top five magazines to get published in. It's at the point where actually for a long time I didn't even approach them, because I just like didn't think I had the chops or didn't have the right story for it. And then I think, you know, quite honestly, like when you're intimidated by a publication like that, you start inventing reasons to not approach them. And then I was like, oh man, I'm not a Southern writer. You know, I'm from Florida, and the South is really about like all the states that are north of Florida and south of the Mason-Dixon. I don't want to write for a Southern magazine. Anybody who identifies themselves as like Southern is not my thing. But the truth is, they just published some really good stuff. And it's a lot of it, of course, is like based in the South, but it's, you know, it's all
human.
Some
stuff even in Florida.
Some in Florida, yeah. Yeah, we got Florida in there, which they've done a lot of times before. But the thing about it is that the thing about writing in the South and growing up being a writer in the South is that there's this like huge stereotype about, first of all, the South. What it means to live here, like, and it feels largely controlled by people who don't live here, actually. Like for me, like New York Times will come down here, New Yorker will come down here, and they'll stick out their elbows and say, we're in the South. And then they'll go to barbecue joints and like look for some molasses and moonshine and, you know, and like find the southern thing they can find, right? And it's like, and then they go back and they write the story, and it sort of perpetuates these stereotypes of the South. But, you know, I mean, I live in a city of 6 million people that...
And how many squirrels?
We're getting there. We're trying to figure that out.
Okay.
There's a lot.
They're everywhere.
Yeah, yeah. And it's like Atlanta is not that type of South. And a lot of the South is not that type of South. And really, so if you start thinking in that way, then it kind of becomes your responsibility to tell the stories of the South that are happening right now. So the stereotypes aren't applied to you so often. So that's what I think the Oxford American is really open to. They love Southern writing, but they also just love really good writing that's like, you know, humanistic and can touch us all from, you know, Washington State to Vermont, Maine.
What are we going to hear today?
So I think I've mentioned this to you, but there's certain things that I don't like to read all the way through, or I feel like they live better on the page.
How about a couple of paragraphs?
Oh yeah, yeah.
Let's do a couple of paragraphs and see how we feel.
Okay. This one's actually broken down into some sections, and so I can stop after section one. And
perfect.
We'll see how it feels. Let me. This is. I'm gonna lean this forward here. Can this move? Is that good with the levels and stuff? Hello.
Yeah, it looks good.
All right, so this was published in the Oxford American in the summer of 2014. It's called Consider the Squirrel. One winter morning a couple of years ago, biking the usual route through my neighborhood east of downtown Atlanta to my preferred coffee shop in MM Park, I happened upon a small tragedy. There in the road, beneath the gloomy Victorian facades, bare oaks, and sagging telephone lines, two squirrels lay dead, side by side, an apparent hit and run, double skewer aside. Like most witnesses, you probably would have kept right on going, but I am a member of the MM Park Squirrel Census. There are seven of us on the team. We count squirrels, make infographics, and throw parties. Among our many self-imposed responsibilities, to document squirrel roadkill in the neighborhood. So, you see, the double squirrel death was a pair of dark aces. I quickly established a crime scene, positioning my bike in the road to block oncoming traffic. I took out my phone, and I started snapping photos. It was a Southern Gothic diorama. The squirrels were facing each other, curled inward like opposite edges of a full moon. They looked asleep, floating, their tails blowing in the same direction. I noticed the chestnut ovals on their back feet, the tender pads on the undersides of their paws, the delicate clip shape of their ears. My mind filled in human fictions. Were they lovers? Was this some kind of suicide pact or a Scura Day Romeo and Juliet? No. I spotted the nipples on the mother squirrel's belly. At first glance, I had been too distracted to notice the slightly smaller size of her offspring lying on the left. The child squirrel's eyes were closed, its arms extended in her direction. Her arms, too, reached out. Between mother and child, a wet stain the size of a half dollar blotted the dark asphalt. Blood splattered the child squirrel's nose as if he had lost a schoolyard fight. That was the only sign of trauma. More fictions. Perhaps the mama was taking her cub out for another lesson, showing where to find food and what to avoid. Maybe the child took a wrong step in the road just as the car was coming and she ran out there too. Maybe they just got blindsided. A neighbor came out of her nearby house and noticed my small fuss in the street. "What happened?" she called, worried. "Two squirrels, run down by a car." "Oh," she said. "Sorry to hear that, I guess." It wasn't a human or a pet. She went back inside. A fellow biker rolled up and surveyed the scene. My bike, the squirrels. "Dude," he said, "did you hit them?" No, a car." He pedaled on, calling back over his shoulder, "Sucks to be a squirrel."
It's sad.
Yeah, it was sad. Yeah. It was sad. It was sad. But at the same time, I felt awkward for it being sad because it was just a squirrel. You know, like people don't really pay attention to the squirrels, and that happens every day.
Why don't we pay attention to the squirrels?
I think it's because, I mean, like the word in their name, you know, the common squirrel, they're just so common and ubiquitous that they're literally the animal we interact with the most aside from... you know, our dogs and cats, maybe birds if you're a bird person, but everybody has a squirrel story. Everybody just sort of sees them all the time. They're so common that we don't pay attention to them.
But yet you do to an incredible extent.
I do. Yeah. Yeah.
Why?
Well, it started with, you know, I have a dog, and like a lot of dogs, she's pretty obsessed with squirrels. And it started when she was young. She found a child squirrel in the backyard of our house and was picking it up and putting it down. And since then, she's just like, you know, every time she sees a squirrel, she absolutely freaks out and wants to get to it. And I don't think she wants to kill it. She wants to put it in her mouth and see. Maybe it's the same squirrel. I don't know. That's me filling in human fictions, right? But it made me look at squirrels in a different way, and I tried to write a story about it from the vantage point of a female dog who's trying to protect her owner because she's convinced that the squirrels are bad, and they're going to come down one day and attack everyone, and she's going to have to protect her owner from it. And then they do in the story, and so it's just her and her owner, and she's got to save him because she loves him more than anything, right? And so I was writing that, and then I was like, well, I mean, I have to draw a picture of that. Like, you know, like they're out in the neighborhood and squirrels are coming down and attacking. What does that look like? How many squirrels would that be? Is it one per person or what's the deal? And so I started calling around to like U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and some other places, and no one really even had like the slightest idea. And it kind of threw me a little bit because I know we know how many rats like approximately are in the city. And I thought they would keep track of that for some reason because, you know, they're disease-carrying animals they're also like, you know, we interact with them every day. So then I was like, huh, that's interesting. And so I started thinking about squirrels a lot more and watching them. And then I started mentioning to some friends, like, what do you think about, like, doing a squirrel census and having absolutely no idea what that meant, like having no idea what the methodology would be or anything, and like really not knowing a whole lot about squirrels. And it set me off personally on this journey to where I've discovered so much about them that I feel like, you know, I'm not an expert, but people come to me and ask me questions about squirrels. And I feel like I understand my environment a lot more now. And you know, I have really come to appreciate the Eastern gray squirrel as an animal. He's not my top animal, but he's definitely in the top 10. It's like they're funny, they're smart, they're super athletic. And I think I've mentioned to you before, when they die really dramatically.
Melodramatically,
yeah. And, you know, I mean, it's like once you start to look at them, then you really appreciate how much they have to face every day just to survive, especially in the city. Every day they wake up and they're just like, man, I just got to get some food and not step on a power line and stay away from that dog and that hawk and that owl and that other squirrel. And if I can get through this day, I'll be okay.
Man, I love it. So, you know, your fiction became your reality. Mm-hmm. And the interest in that reality has perpetuated it probably from like growing up, like your experiences, like your childhood. You are competitive, but you look out for the underdog. And the squirrel's an underdog.
Total underdog, yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, you've lived in some ways this fantastic underdog life. Maybe we can tell folks about the baseball, you know, World mm-hmm. Series real quick mm-hmm. As an anecdote to that.
Oh, yeah. So let's see. So I was never the best student. And I went off to college after my senior year. I was supposed to be drafted in the top 10 rounds as a left-handed pitcher. And then I had a complete collapse. Like it was a complete and total collapse to the point that not only did major league teams not want me, like no college wanted me. No one wanted me. So I had to walk on to, I barely got into the local university, walked on there, and the pitching coach had to see me throw first. I had to go throw for him. And about halfway through, his name is Spanky McFarland. I remember him cupping his hands together and going, okay, so this is you, okay? You're like a baby bird, and I'm gonna nurse you back. I'm gonna nurse you out of the nest and make you stronger. And he did, like for the next year at school there, like I relearned how to pitch and built up my confidence again. At the same time, however, I was failing out of school and I completely failed out, like, you know, and so had a talk with my coaches and they said, go to this community college around the corner in Tampa where basically like all the people go who can't get into other colleges, right? And so I went to this college and joined the baseball team there, which had pretty much done nothing. You know, if they competed at the state level, then they were happy with that. So I went there and joined this team that was basically full of a lot of misfits like myself. And we started playing some games and losing. And about halfway through the season, actually probably like a third of the way through the season, our head coach said, you guys don't realize you have so much talent and you're gonna blow it. You could be going to the Junior College World Series, but you're blowing it. You're not even gonna make it to the state playoffs. And we all literally looked at each other and said, there's a Junior College World Series? Like we had no idea. And so from that point on, we kind of jokingly, you know, thought about it, but we qualified for the playoffs in the last game of the year to go to state. We lost our first game at state. And then in the final game, we ended up winning. And in the last game, in the last inning, we ended up winning that game. So we won state. Then we went to region, and we were the team with the worst record there, of course. And the same thing happened, lost first game, then won, won the thing. So then we went to the junior. We had making it to the Junior College World Series.
Now, what is the name of this team? And what uniform did you wear?
It's Harrellsburg Community College, the Hawks. Our uniforms at the time were either white with red and blue stripes, or sometimes we broke out a red shirt for, I don't know if that was home or away. That would be away. That was away. We went to this Junior College World Series, and our record, I think, at the time was like 39-29 or something like that. Like, barely making it. And we were playing teams that were from Texas and Oklahoma that played triple headers that were 80-2 and like 75-7. I mean, like, these guys, and they were serious about baseball. And we were the type.
I wish I were 75-7 on sleeping.
Yeah.
It is tough out there for a parent with a one-year-old.
Or a teenager.
Great. Awesome.
And so anyway, by the way, I should say, just to be clear, that, you know, I've talked to the guys since then. We're probably going to write about this story together. But I had a really good season. But then when I went to the playoffs, I, again, completely collapsed, kind of like senior year kind of thing, and just had the absolute worst playoffs you can possibly imagine. So when I pitched in the Junior College World Series, I have a record that still stands there. My earned run average is infinite. Like, I didn't record a single out, and I think I gave up 8 runs. And finally, they just took me out of the game. And so that's a record that can never be broken. So all these misfits go to this, junior college world series, and, we pieced together win after win, and we started making the teams really mad because they didn't like losing to us. And then we go back to the hotel and play wiffle ball in the parking lot, and their coaches wouldn't allow them out of their rooms, you know, and we're just goofing off. And then a virus hit the team. Like, it swept through half of the team, and I was one that got it too, and was one of the several people that had to be taken to the hospital because we lost so much fluid. And another guy sitting on the bed next to me, John Farrell, he got hit by the virus as well. But the thing was, he wasn't playing badly like I was. He was our top hitter. And so we're laying together next to each other at the hospital taking IVs. And I took 2, which is like, you're really dehydrated. And he took 3, and then they gave him a 4th. And the championship game was the next day. And everyone was like, oh, John's not playing. He's like, he can't recover from this. This is terrible. And the next day he got up and he said, I'm playing. And we were playing the team that was like, you know, San Jacinto, Texas, that was like, had won the previous year and would win the next year. And he led off the game with a home run. And we ended up, I can't remember the final score of the game, but we ended up winning the Junior College World Series.
That's awesome. Yeah. Did y'all go berserk?
Yeah, we went crazy, and then we came home, and we were heroes in Tampa. Suddenly, the college that no one wanted to go to was, like, on the front page of the paper, and there was, like, I think the governor named a day after us, and it was a pretty big deal. It was fun, yeah.
I think it's so fun. It's so cool. I mean, and I see the connection with all this stuff. I mean, I see it with
you do?
Writing, and what I see it with Squirrel. It's a come from behind. It's a celebrate the underdog. It's share a good story. Mm-hmm. And if you share it well, people can relate to it and get behind it, and you turn around like you just said with it's the front page of the paper, you know, and it attracts people, and I think you've done that. You all with them in Park Squirrel Sense have done that very well. You have attracted the attention of creative community and now beyond. I think this is a good time to tell people about how they can get involved with the Squirrel Census, kind of what your plan is quickly, and then we'll do a little bit more reading. But
it. So the last census we did was in 2012, and it was ended up being a Kickstarter project of the year. And we've sort of ridden that for the last couple of years. And it's a project that won't go away. People keep coming to us and talking to us about it or having us speak places. And so we said, let's do another count. We're going to do another count. We've been meaning to for a while. And so now this October, we are doing a bigger and better count. We're going to do, a more thorough count of Inman Park. We've discovered a couple of little problems with our methodology that we're correcting.
What is the methodology called?
It's named after this guy, Von Flieger. I think that's how you pronounce his name. And he was considered the foremost squirrel expert in the world. He studied them for decades.
Okay.
Yeah. And so we're doing a count of Inman Park, but then we're going to do some satellite counts of surrounding parks. And then we have instituted a new program called the Squirrel Census Ambassador Program at colleges. And so we have Squirrel Census Ambassadors at, I think, a dozen colleges now across up the East Coast. And they're going to do little mini counts on their campus. And we're looking to expand from there. But if people want to get involved, we need volunteers to come out and count squirrels with us. And it requires about 2 hours of your time to do one thing. And so if you email volunteers@squirrelcensus.com, we'll put you on the list. And throughout October, you can pick when you want to count, a particular day for a couple of hours. And then what we're going to do is take all the data and all the stories that we gather and sit on them for a couple of months over the winter break, essentially. And then we're going to, just like a census team does, we're going to present our findings in the forms of to be determined fun stuff.
I love it. Well, I know that you also have the ability to have folks sponsor the census. Mm-hmm. And on behalf of the Kansas family, Sidewalk Radio, and Gene Kansas Commercial Real Estate, may I present you with a check
for sponsorship.
Thank you.
Wow, thank you, Gene. That is great.
That's the second check we presented. We did one of Big Brothers Big Sisters, too. You're in good company.
This is great. This is going to buy a lot of beer.
That's awesome. I love supporting people's drinking habits. So let's do another quick little reading from the Oxford American as it relates to squirrels, and then maybe wrap up with a touch of the Hemingway House.
Okay. Let's see. What's the favorite part that I like to read here? And by favorite, I mean least awkward for me. I already told you about that. Some of the stuff I actually pulled from the magazine. I'll read the last part. And if people want to read it, it's the Oxford American Summer 2014, and I'm sorry that I'm reading the end for you.
Spoiler alert.
Spoiler alert here. One day last winter, on a walk at dusk, I passed my neighbor's house and noticed the scene. Michael was in his backyard with his wife, Erica, and they were both looking at something he cupped in his gloved hands. "What do you have there?" I asked as I approached. "A squirrel?" I was kidding. He knows about the squirrel census and often asks if we are going to count possum next. "Come take a look," he said. He opened his hands, and there it was. A scrawny, eyes closed, male, eastern gray pup. It couldn't have been more than a month old. Like most animal babies, it looked ridiculous and adorable. Thin tail, skinny feet, no idea what was happening to it. Completely helpless. Michael had been trimming a tree, he explained. In the down branches, he found a small cocoon-like nest that held the child. "And now you're here to take care of it," Erica offered. I do admit that I felt an immediate responsibility to the squirrel. We searched for signs of the mother or perhaps other children. The descending dark offered nothing. I got on the phone with Miranda, a friend who had once found an injured baby squirrel and raised it to a healthy adult. It is illegal to keep squirrels as pets in Atlanta, though it is legal to kill them. But I knew Miranda had connections to an underground network of squirrel friends who took in young babes like the one Michael found. We devised a plan. I agreed to keep the squirrel overnight in a box filled with nesting material. The next afternoon, a cold front would pass through, so we had the morning to reunite him with his mother. If we failed, we would have to consider finding other shelter and food. That night, I slept on the couch next to the box that held the lanky kid. I woke each time he rustled in the bedding, his claws dry scraping against the cardboard. I took him out a couple of times, holding him in a small towel. I tried to administer drops of Pedialyte through a dropper, but he would snatch away his mouth each time. I worried that my clumsy care would kill him. I was Lenny in Of Mice and Men. I slept fitfully, awoke unsettled, fell unconscious again. I had a dream that I took in several animals, that I couldn't stop taking in animals. In the morning, I thought of my sister, who has never met an abandoned dog or cat that she refused to love. A text from Michael buzzed my phone. The mother squirrel was back in the tree, climbing, maybe searching. I came running over with the colorful box, but she scampered away over Michael's roof. And so with Michael supporting the ladder, I climbed the tree. I wedged the box containing the child squirrel between branches near a nest we had failed to see in the fading light the night before. If the kid was still in the box come lunchtime, we'd move him back inside before it got too cold. "Look over your shoulder," Michael said, as I double-checked that the box was secure. I turned around and, on Michael's roof, there she was, the mama, looking right at us. It didn't take 15 minutes. She smelled her baby inside the box, tore out all the nesting material, and grabbed him by the neck. He wrapped himself around her head, and off they went, straight into Michael's attic. It occurs to me, I said to Michael.
That's awesome.
That maybe you're not really into saving squirrels, you know? That you only did this because of me, especially if the squirrels are now nesting in your attic. He laughed. No, he said. The way I see it, we're animals, and we're here to help the other animals. Spoken like a true squirrel friend.
I love it, man.
Thanks.
Very, very well done. Great writing, great image. I had to laugh. One, it's a funny line, but also we had a guy come out to the house, pest control. And he went up into the attic to, like, I don't know, spray or do whatever they do up there. And he came down and he said, "You know, you've got some rodent activity up there." And I was like, "How do you know?" And he goes, "Because a squirrel looked me dead in the eye and ran straight out the side of the house." And I said, "Other than that, were there any clues?"
It's all science.
This has been so fun. Thank you so much for joining.
Thanks for having me.
This Y'all, get involved with the squirrel census.
Yeah, we'd love to have the help.
Yeah, man. Good job. Keep it up. Thank you so much.
Thank you.